Hello, I'm Don Machholtz, and you are listening to Looking Up with Don. This is the Looking Up with Don podcast, episode number 21 for the week of May 27th, 2020. The related website for this podcast is donmachholtz.com. That is spelled donmachholz.com. Two H's. What's up in the sky this week? As our week begins on Wednesday, May 27th, the moon is halfway to first quarter in the evening sky, becoming more of an influence each evening. By the end of this week, June 2nd, the moon will be bright and nearly full. Just a heads up, not for this week, but for the following week. On June 5th, the moon will be full and there will be a prenumbral lunar eclipse. It will be visible from southern Europe, most of Africa, that is, well, Western Africa, Australia, and the Antarctica. The southern part of the moon will be covered by the outer shadow of the Earth. It's not very dazzling, but it is a subtle shading. We will discuss that more next week. You have to make an appearance early in the evening to see the planet Venus in the evening sky. It's quickly and quietly slipping in front of the sun on June 3rd. This is called an inferior conjunction, not because it's not as important, but because it's on our side of the sun. Venus is between us and the sun. Actually, it is passing just north of the sun and will not be crossing the face of the sun as seen from the Earth. The other type of conjunction is called a superior conjunction. That is when Venus, or any planet, passes on the opposite side of the sun from us. One more planetary alignment is called opposition. What is when we, the Earth, is between an outer planet and the sun? Then the planet is like the full moon in our sky. It rises at sunset, and it sets at sunrise. It's up all night. The planet is generally closest to us that week of opposition. It's at its brightest, and we have our best view of it. For Mars, this happens every 2.2 years. Opposition this year is on October 13th. For Jupiter, opposition is July 14th. And for Saturn, it is July 20th. These two planets are close together. As Venus leaves the stage, the planet Mercury takes over. It hangs out in our western evening sky all week at about magnitude zero, slowly dimming through the week. It sets about an hour after sunset. In the morning sky, we have three major planets, Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars. Jupiter and Saturn rise about midnight, and Mars rises 2 hours later. If you stay up to see these objects, you'll be treated to the summer Milky Way rising in the east. I had a short stay in the hospital last week with respiratory issues. I was tested for the coronavirus, and I do not have it. Instead, it is probably bronchitis or pneumonia. I'm being treated, and I'm starting to do better. People appreciate seeing the International Space Station pass overhead. It's bright, it's predictable, and there's people living and working in it. When you look for the ISS, as it's often called, also look for any other vehicles leading it or following it. These cargo ships and the capsules that carry astronauts often ferry back and forth from Earth to the International Space Station and can often be seen a few minutes before or after the ISS, or sometimes very close to it. Also, I've been impressed by the images of the ISS I see on Twitter, taken by amateur astronomers as the ISS passes by. At a distance of 300 miles, the ISS still shows some details in those telescopic images. I have visually seen some shape to the ISS in a telescope with as little as 50 magnification. Keeping it in the field of view, now that's the hard part. Will you be able to see the International Space Station this week? If you live north of 50 degrees north, you'll see it in your evening sky for the first few days of the week and then none. Canada, the Netherlands, you'll have a few good nights here. Between about 30 degrees and 50 degrees north, you can find it in our evening sky, sometimes twice per night. Spain, Italy, Japan, get out in the evenings and look up. Between 20 and 30 degrees north, it will start appearing in your evening sky by the end of the week. Most of the rest of the world will not be able to see it at all this week. The exception is at minus 40 degrees in south, it will be in your morning sky. That is you, New Zealand. To determine where it will be in your sky, you can go to the website, heavens-above.com, and enter your location, then click on ISS. Now for the comets that we can see this week. Use Podcast 20, Maps 3 and 4, free from my website, to locate the comets in our northern evening sky. Podcast 20 was last week's, but those maps are still good for this week's. Ephemerides for these comets are found on my website too. Podcast 19, Comet Positions. Let's take care of old business first. Comet 2019 Y4, Atlas, is now too close to the sun to be seen from the Earth, and besides, it's dimmed significantly and likely will not be visually seen again. Comet 2019 Y1, Atlas, is fading in our evening sky, now about magnitude 10.5. It had a good run, and it did well. Comet 2020 F8 Swan has dimmed significantly in the last few weeks. I had mentioned in one of these podcasts that we in the Northern Hemisphere would get our first view on May 7th, as the comet was rapidly moving northward in the morning sky. I picked it up on May 6th, and I've followed it since then. The problem the comet had was that it was diffuse and it lacked the bright central condensation, that is the nuclear region, and it blended in well with the background sky, making it difficult to see. Over the following weeks, it did not get better, but continued to fade. I'm having trouble seeing it these days. You can use Podcast 20, Map 3 to search for it in the evening sky. It reaches its highest point in the evening sky on June 1st, but it is dim. Comet 2017 T2 Pan-STARRS. It's still doing well, magnitude 8.5 or so, and it's in the evening sky near the bowl of the Big Dipper. It's been a steady performer this whole time. I'll be discussing great comets and what makes a great comet on next week's podcast, and some thoughts about what went wrong with comets Atlas and Swan. Now for new business. Two more comets will be featured in this podcast in coming weeks. One is Comet 2019 U6 Lemon, and the other is Comet 2020 F3 Neowise. Both are visible exclusively from the southern hemisphere in the evening sky. Comet Lemon is near the star Cirrus, and Comet Neowise is near Orion. We'll get more into these comets next week. During the second week of August, three comets, Pan-STARRS, that's the one we've been following, Comet 2020 F3 Neowise, and Comet 2019 U6 Lemon, will all be bunched up within 15 degrees of each other, and on August 2nd, Comet Pan-STARRS and Lemon will be within 2 degrees of each other. All this takes place near the bright star Arcturus in the northern evening sky. We will discuss that more as we approach August. This week, we'll be looking at one of the most popular stars in the sky. It's visible from only one hemisphere. It is sometimes called the brightest star in the sky, but it isn't. I'm talking about the North Star, properly known as Polaris. Polaris can be found by using the pointers on the Big Dipper. The pointers are the two end stars in the bowl of the Dipper. They are about 5 degrees apart. Go 6 times that distance to get to Polaris. If the Big Dipper is not easily visible, then use Cassiopeia. It is also identified on Podcast 21, Map 1. Polaris is within 1 degree of true north. Our North Pole slowly migrates, and in the year 2100, it reaches its closest point to Polaris, less than 1/2 degree. So it doesn't rise, and it doesn't set. Those long exposure images you see of circular star trails, that bright star you see in the center making a real tiny circle, that's Polaris. When astronomers are culminating their telescopes, testing their optics or measuring their field of view, they often use this star because it's bright and it hardly moves. Your latitude north of the equator is how high Polaris is in your sky. At the North Pole, Polaris would be overhead. On the equator, it's on your northern horizon. And if you live at, say, 35 degrees, it's 35 degrees up. It doesn't move unless you move north or south. Polaris shines at an average magnitude of 1.98, but varies between 1.86 and 2.13 every 4 days. It's a Cepheid variable, 50 times larger than our sun and 6 times the mass of our sun. It is believed that 2,000 years ago it was a magnitude fainter. The variability of Polaris has decreased and increased even in the last few decades. Having said all that, Polaris is the 50th brightest star in the sky. Sometimes you hear people say it's the brightest star in the sky, but it isn't. The distance to Polaris is 433 light years. Polaris has two companions, but one of them is very close to Polaris, and at magnitude 9.2, it is not visible. The other companion is magnitude 8.7, and 18 arc seconds from Polaris. That one is visible in most telescopes. There are 2,400 astronomical units between this star and Polaris. You could fit 40 of our solar systems between these two stars. And by solar system, I mean everything inside the orbit of Neptune, the sun, and all the planets. This is a star we would often show at public star parties, and it does generate a lot of interest. Everyone has heard of the North Star, and they are happy to finally be able to see it. This is one good star to learn. Our unaided eye challenge this week is to locate the North Star. Use the pointer stars in the Big Dipper, which these evenings are nearly overhead. Look up to the north. That's Polaris. Sheltered in place, it's not careless. Neither setting nor rising. Stuck above the horizon. With no place to hide when embarrassed. Our challenge with binoculars is to look at the field around it. Very pretty. With a telescope, look at Polaris and pick up the companion star, magnitude 8.7 and 18 arc seconds away. The secondary is about 250 times fainter than the primary. To sharpen our eyesight, let's try these exercises. With the unaided eye and binoculars, see how soon after sunset you can see this second magnitude star. You know where it is. It hardly moves. So some night, line it up with the top of a tree or the corner of a building roof line. Mark the spot where you are standing. The next evening in twilight, go back to that spot and start searching for Polaris. You know where it is. Now it is a matter of seeing it. You will pick it up in binoculars before you see it with the unaided eye. This exercise will help you to better find things in the twilight sky. Get really good at it. As for how soon after sunset can you see it, due to the ever-changing declination of the sun through the year, the sky naturally darkens more quickly in the winter than it does in the summer. For those with telescopes, we have a slightly different challenge, seeing it in the daytime. Stars and the brighter planets can be seen in the daytime, but this is the 50th brightest star. With the telescope's limited field of view, the exact position of Polaris does matter, because in the course of a night, its slight hourly movement does make a difference and drift it out of your field of view. So its position is right ascension, 2 hours 32 minutes, declination, 89 degrees 15 minutes, meaning it is 45 arc minutes, which is about 3/4 of a degree from the true pole, and pulling toward Cassiopeia. So keep that in mind when you set up your telescope at the end of a session, so that it will be in your daylight field perhaps 12 hours later. Building a pair of big binoculars, and for this, see the photo page that's identified on my website as Podcast 21, Big Binocular Photos. Let me begin this segment by saying two things. First, I do not spend a lot of money on my hobby of astronomy. Never have, and sometimes my hobby has suffered from it. I'd rather feed the family than have some more astronomy equipment. I also learned to make a lot of things myself, as that is less expensive. Secondly, I'm not particularly good at building things. Yes, I've built telescopes, eyepieces, these binoculars, decks, bookcases, and they all worked rather well, but not something to write home about. I work best with wood. Those with a machine shop or access to metalwork could probably do much better. In early 1983, I went to the San Jose Astronomical Association swap meet held in Los Gatos, California. It is held once or twice a year where amateur astronomers bring stuff to sell. Others are there to buy. I usually do not buy anything, but I do like the event. My wife and I went, and two large aerial lenses were open to bid. They are war surplus, each has 5 optics, and each lens weighs 22 pounds. The front lens is 6.1 inches in diameter, and the back lens is 4.5 inches across. They were made by Bell and Howe. The bid was $50 each. I looked them over, but for the life of me, could not figure out what I would do with these two lenses. I had to leave the auction before the lenses were bid upon, and that was it. In the ensuing days, I kept thinking about those two lenses, and the thought finally occurred to me. Could I make a pair of binoculars out of these lenses? So I called Jim Van Nuland, the secretary and treasurer of the auction, to find out if they had been sold and who had bought them. He said they had not sold and that Steve Greenberg, who lived in Livermore, California, had brought them. I called Steve and he still had them and was willing to sell them to me for $50 each. I asked if he could put them on hold for me. I then spent the next 10 days determining if I could build a pair of binoculars inexpensively with these lenses. If I could not, then this would be a no deal. Most binoculars use prisms to move the light paths closer together. That is necessary because if the binocular objectives are, for instance, 3 inches across, then the two parallel light paths are 3 inches apart. If your eyes are 2 inches apart, then the two beams of light need to be closer together. In most binoculars, this is done with 2 prisms for each light path. Prisms are expensive, and I would have to find another way. Diagonal mirrors are used as secondary mirrors in telescopes and can perform the same purpose as a prism. Could I possibly use them? I determined what sizes I would need and looked up the prices in astronomy parts catalogs for 4 mirrors and 4 mirror holders. It came to about $80. Now, what about the eyepieces? I wanted 2-inch diameter ones, matching and cheap. I found some in the Edmunds catalog. They are item number 60144. They were selling for $4.50 each in their 1962 catalog, but by 1983, the price had been jacked up to $12 each. They are 30 millimeter plossos, but identified as Kellners in the ad. They come in a brass mount 2.06 inches in diameter. Next, I had to solve this problem. How do I mount the heavy lens cells, diagonal mirrors, and eyepieces and keep them all aligned? I figured I could make a plywood box 3 feet long, 2 feet wide, and 1 foot deep. Then this. How do I mount such a box? I do not know, but I figured I could put some type of pipe mount together. I used one for the 10-inch reflector, and it worked fine. All in all, I figured I could build the whole thing for $300. I asked my wife, and she said, go ahead. We went to Steve's house and bought the lenses. One has a focal length of 913 millimeters, and the other is 921 millimeters. There's a 1% difference, and I figured I could probably work with that. I ordered the optics by sending checks to the companies. That's how you did it back then. I bought the wood and pipes at a local hardware store. Then followed 2 weeks of work in the garage on weekends and after work on weekdays. Big brackets held the lens cells. Brackets held wood blocks holding the mirror cells. And PVC pipe held each of the 2 eyepieces. Originally, I had set up some long threaded rods holding the final 2 mirrors and eyepieces, which could be readjusted to change the distance between the eyepieces. After about 6 months, I realized I was the only one using them, and this setup made it difficult to keep alignment. So I removed that apparatus and replaced it with a fixed pupillary distance of 64 millimeters to match my eyes. The binocular box with optics and the top portion of the mount weighs 122 pounds, or about 55 kilograms. It cannot be lifted onto the mount, at least I can't do that. So I learned to tilt the mount down, screw the pipe on the box to the pipe mount, then pull it back up. I did it that way many times for many years. This pair of binoculars show great contrast. With it, I could sweep up diffuse objects about as well as I could with my 10-inch reflector at f3.8. The difference being that with the 10-inch telescope, condensed objects were more apparent as it had a larger aperture, while very diffuse objects were better found in the binoculars. These are telephoto lenses, not simple telescope lenses. At the stated focal length of 36 inches, or 925 millimeters, and f8, that comes out to an effective aperture of 36 divided by 8, or 4.5 inches in size. Yet the front objective is 6.1 inches in diameter, so it's gathering 6 inches of light, and the 5 lenses inside, the last one being a minus lens, takes this light and narrows it down for the final lens, which is 4.5 inches across. I have used eyepieces of known focal length and measured the exit pupil and came out with an effective aperture of about 5.3 inches. That is assuming the stated focal length of 36 inches. Whether it be 913 or 921 millimeters is correct. Yet the light path is less than 36 inches, and that is due to all the optical magic inside the lens cell. The magnification with this instrument and those eyepieces, which are actually 32 millimeter focal length, is about 29 power. Field of view is about 2.3 degrees. I have used those binoculars for several thousand hours of comet hunting. I discovered four comets with it in 1986 and 1988, and two comets in 1994. It and my 10-inch reflector were interchangeable. Some night I would use one, the next night the other. It transported well in the back of the pickup truck, and on three occasions I took it to the Riverside Telescope Makers Conference. From 1993 through 1998, the binoculars were in my observatory in Colfax on wheels. With that roll-off roof observatory, something I'll discuss in some future podcast, I did not even need to roll the roof down, but instead just remove one or two plywood panels and poke the binoculars out the side to the east or west. Now that I have moved to Arizona, I have the binoculars in the shop, which opens up to the east for comet hunting. But with fewer bright comets available for discovery, I seldom use it anymore for comet hunting. Instead, I use my 18-inch reflector. The binoculars are still a fun instrument for scanning around the skies, especially the Milky Way. You have been listening to Looking Up with Don, podcast episode 21 for May 27th, 2020. Once again, the related website for this podcast is donmachels.com. That is spelled donmachhols.com. Two H's. God willing and pod willing, I'll be back next week for another episode of Looking Up with Don. We will discuss what's going on in the sky, what makes a great comet, and music that astronomers listen to while looking at the stars. Thank you for listening. See the sky this week. I'll see you next week.